So, hi everyone, and welcome to episode 14 of Ooh. Zoology Ramblings with me, Emma, and Roby.
Hello!
And first time ever, we are in the same place. This is not over Zoom, this is not over Skype. We're in the same room.
It feels so strange. It actually does. I don't quite know where to look because like, I feel like I'm just looking at the microphone, but I'd normally just be talking at you, but you're on a screen. It's very strange, but it's really sweet because we are in Pembrokeshire. In a lovely little cottage, and we're off looking for otters on our holiday. And it is basically a year ago this mm-hmm. summer in Pembrokeshire, we sat down in the same cottage and we were like, oh, we should really start a podcast.
Yeah, this was the birthplace of Zoology Ramblings. Because we were sat at the kitchen table and it was
we were talking about a three-hour conversation.
Yeah. We got to the end of it like, we should record this.
I honestly think we covered canned hunting, we covered trophy hunting, we covered
exotic
the pet trade, all in one conversation. And our friend was, I think, dozing in the other room, and I can't imagine what they were thinking.
I think they came back down and they're like, you're still talking. It's like, yes.
And also, probably, I think we could probably say the birthplace of Biome as well, because on that same trip we were making our first ever little film about the otters. Again, the same otters. We're back to see them. We saw them the first time. We're going to see them again, hopefully, this time. We've got some camera traps out. But yeah, it feels weird. We've gone a whole year and we've come so far.
I know, it is exciting looking back at all the content and just, yeah, I think seeing how far we have come with Zoology Ramblings and Biome as well.
And the Spotify Next Wave, that was pretty cool.
Yes, we're so, so hyped that we got, I mean, that chance to spread the message more, I think, because now it's, for those of you who don't know, it's if you go on the Student Hub section on Spotify, you can now see our podcast along with the seven others that won the Next Wave initiative. And it's, we've got the cool cover art with like little sketchy badges.
Thank you so much for a really awesome cover art graphic designer. Who designed that for us. That was really fantastic. So today we're going to try and stick to the normal, well, I say the normal, we seem
the
to...
The latest.
Yeah, the latest format. We do seem to change our structure every episode. But again, this time we've got an animal of the week, a news set, no, we'll do news first, animal of the week, and then conservation story of the week, which is what we did, or we tried to do last time.
I think that works well, because at the beginning it was more kind of UK conservation topics and... I think because we've covered quite a lot of those.
Yeah.
Conservation news
we've done
can,
them
be,
all.
Can be anything.
we've done everything in the UK. We've done the UK. Yeah, exactly.
I mean, we were talking about that yesterday when we were sat in the garden having wine and olives, as you do.
Bird watching.
Best kind of bird watching.
Bird watching with good wine, good friends. We saw a kingfisher. We saw a sparrowhawk. We got
heron.
Yeah, lovely. And a woodpecker. That was nice. The woodpecker.
Greenshank.
I mean, a greenshank.
They were nice.
Yeah.
But we were saying that about the UK, as much as we do love UK wildlife and we appreciate everything we've learned about it, it's almost like it's so lacking.
Yeah.
It's the fact that we are now running out of things almost to talk about UK conservation wise. It's like, can we reintroduce some more stuff, please?
Yeah, then we can talk about it. Come on, we need to bring back the wings. We need to bring back the links purely so we can talk about it. Shall we start with the news? Emma, what's your news?
My news is, I feel like I never shut up about beavers, but...
You never shut up about beavers.
But it's about beavers.
Neither do I, so it's fine, you know?
I mean, I feel like no one should. They're absolutely awesome, epic animals, and we absolutely love seeing them in Devon.
Yeah.
That was quite recently as well. That was Beavers Part 2.
Done a lot of adventuring this year, actually. We actually have, when you think about it. If you'd like to check out that little film, we've got Beavers Part 1 up on Biome on YouTube. If you Google the Biome Project on YouTube, we've got our first beaver vlog down there. And then our second one, a longer form documentary, should be out fairly soon. Mm-hmm. As soon as we get our act together and actually write the damn thing. We've got all the footage and we planned it. We haven't actually done it yet.
I feel like we slightly overcommit to things. We're like, we're going to do like 6 mull documentaries. Yeah. We've got beavers. We're going to go film otters. But I felt I wanted to update you guys on some very exciting beaver news that is happening in England, actually, not just in the UK. This is mainly about England. And so the government is looking to give beavers legal protection in England.
Finally. This is as a native species.
Yes, as a native species, yeah.
Oh,
so
yes.
Already happened in Scotland in 2019.
Who did it?
Although there's a little loophole there. that you can still shoot beavers if they damage your land.
Yeah.
So actually in Derek Gowles's book, Bringing Back the Beaver, it's that he actually says Scotland could be the first kind of nation in the Guinness Book of Records actually to bring back beavers and then proceed to cull them.
Yeah, like, and lose them again. Yeah,
I just find that bonkers because you could easily translocate them. And hopefully now that they will be considered a native species, that
hopefully translocate them to England. Like, if you've got beavers which are damaging your farmland, cool, dump them in Cambridgeshire. I don't know why I picked Cambridgeshire.
But, so this will come into effect in 2022.
Okay.
Here, so not that far away, really, when you think about it.
2021's flown by.
And what this means is that it'll make it a legal offence to deliberately kill, disturb, or injure beavers or damage their breeding sites or resting places.
Oh, cool. Fantastic.
So that's some really good benchmarks there to protect them. But they have said it's kind of a cautious return of these semi-aquatic mammals. So very UK government attitude to take towards this.
Yeah, it's not be cautious.
It's not like, okay, just suddenly yes, beavers are okay. Which is also, you do need caution.
Yeah.
But I think the idea behind this is that you still need licenses.
Right.
But you need to meet certain criteria.
Right.
For them to be able to be wild.
And it'll be interesting if this new piece of legislation affects the 5-year trial period, which you currently need if you're wanting to bring beavers back with, you know, fences and things. So we've got some quite good family friends down here in Pembrokeshire, actually, who are trying to start getting the ball rolling of reintroducing beavers. And one of their, you know, big hurdles is that they have to raise, I think it's like $30,000 just for this fence to go around, a fence trial enclosure for 5 years. So it'd be interesting if, you know, if they're classed as a native animal now and protected as a native species, will they still need that really long trial period? I would hope not, because as Derek Gow says often and loudly, and good to him for saying it, we don't need any more trials. We know everything there is to know about beavers and what they do here, you know.
I think they quite like the element of control.
Yes.
So the idea of, if you have beavers in fenced in enclosures and you know they're there for 5 years, there is that, okay, we know those beavers are there, but they're not going to go build a dam in this random field, because obviously it's all about planning. They need to make sure that the farmers whose land it could affect are compensated in advance and things like that, because otherwise, if you have like a Scotland model, whereas they damage land and then you shoot them,
That is true.
You do need the planning in place.
Yeah.
And actually, you guys can have your say as well. We've had ours.
I've voted.
We voted for the beavers. They're going to run the world.
Beaver. Don't vote for Labour. Don't vote for Conservative. Vote beaver.
You know what? They would get my vote. So it's DEFRA, which is the Department for Environment, Food and Rural Affairs. They're launching this 12-week consultation report, basically, about further reintroductions of beavers into the wild and how we can best manage the existing populations that we already have.
I mean, it's good that they're doing that, but I don't know why. Maybe it's the nihilist in me or the anarchist. Whenever anyone says how we can best manage them, I always think, they don't need to be managed, just it's fine, just leave them alone. But then the realist in me is always like, no, realistically, humans and beavers, we share the environment, there's not much wilderness left, we have to manage ourselves, we also have to manage them, and vice versa. Yep. But even so, it does tickle me in my little anarchy spot. I'm like, no management, just beavers everywhere. But obviously that's a silly idea, obviously.
But I think it is that thing, it's, even though they are a wild species, there's, in somewhere like the UK, there's always going to be management.
Yeah.
Because if they increase in numbers and they start exploding in populations, I would argue our ecosystem could support significantly more beavers than we do now. But obviously they want to know where they are, what they're doing. But a lot of this has been based on the Devon beavers, like the fact that it has been so successful and they've made that their home.
Yeah.
This is partly why they're now considering this in more parts of the UK.
I mean, someone looked at it was it Belgium or somewhere? Maybe it was Sweden, I'm not quite sure. And they looked at it and they looked at cumulatively, they figured out that, you know, thriving population of beavers, oh, maybe it was Norway in Telemark, thriving population of beavers, And despite this, they still cause less damage every year than the red fox does to livestock and agriculture, and, you know, burrowing under fences and letting out the sheep and lambing and things like that. And so, I'm kind of, in my ideal world, we'd just have beavers everywhere. And yeah, sometimes they're a problem in the same way foxes are a problem. And, you know, sometimes they get hit by cars or that sort of thing. But there's enough of them in the wild population that we kind of don't need to manage them. We just forget about them, and they just exist in the way foxes do and badgers do. And I know foxes and badgers come with their own problems, but I'd like to see them ubiquitous. You know, you go to a river, you're probably going to see a beaver. And that's cool. That's lovely. That's what I'm going for, I think, with beavers.
And also, a bit of a devil's advocate, kind of controversial comment that I'm going to make now. But if we're talking about the management of landscapes for the benefit of, say, facing the climate emergency or biodiversity crises, we would not be managing the landscape in the way that we do with the number of cows that we do.
Exactly.
We've talked about this before in a podcast about like the spread of TB and things like that. But the way we're managing cattle and moving them around the country on the scale that we're doing it at...
And sheep.
...is not sustainable. There are ways... We're not... saying boycott farming, absolutely, we've talked about this so much. It's like farmers and farming is crucial moving forwards in the future, but there's a way to do this alongside the natural world.
It's always like, why are we thinking about managing beavers when beavers do far less bad for us and the planet than the current agricultural system, you know, including cows and these sorts of things. I don't know, maybe that's just the little things that get us annoyed.
But I mean, the idea with management as well, beavers are kind of their own managers.
Yeah, we've
talked about them before. You can check out previous podcasts for endless beaver content until your heart's content. But the idea that they are ecosystem engineers and through felling trees, dam building, they slow down water, they filter sediments and pollutants and things like that. They also attract wildlife and they can reduce flooding downstream.
Yeah.
And so it's kind of, they are vital, especially as we're on a tipping point with biodiversity and the climate emergencies. We need these nature-based solutions now, which is why it is really positive that 2022, it's possible that way more could be seen here, and they generate these fantastic wetlands and flooded forests that we've seen before. So I think it's very positive.
Yeah, it's just, good news.
It's just a very British approach to take it so cautiously.
And you know, I was watching a YouTube video, I can't remember what it was, and it was a back and forth. So Derek Gow was on the video, and then it might have been that summit, the Rewilding Summit we watched. Derek Gow's going back and forth with a lady who I think is involved in beaver conservation, and she's kind of on the DEFRA angle of it. And she was like, yeah, part of the reason we're cautious and part of the reason we're taking it slowly is because if we just let the beavers do their own thing, you will have, you know, beavers getting hit by cars and things, which we don't want. And in my head, I was like, actually, and obviously I don't want beavers being hit by cars, but actually I wouldn't care so much if the beaver population was large and healthy and that was a single factor controlling it, you know, in the same way that I'm not particularly bothered if I see a fox that's been hit by a car, because I know there are loads of foxes and they're naturally regulating their own populations, and the weak ones will die and the strong ones will survive, and that's, you know, natural selection and things. This argument that, oh, we can't release too many beavers because then we'd have to manage them to make sure they don't die necessarily. It's like, well, actually, in any species, in any population, animals die. All animals die. We all die. And that's natural. And, you know, some of them starve. And I remember that came up in the River Otter beaver trial. They're like, oh, we're worried. What if some of them starve? I'm like, well, animals do starve every year. Every winter, a proportion of the population will die. And the fit ones are the ones who can get past that and reproduce. But maybe that's just me, my fantasy of a healthy, self-sustaining beaver population. I do acknowledge we will just have to manage these things for quite a while.
I mean, I definitely agree with that. But I think it... the only reason it would be good for sort of everyone to know where they are is also kind of from the tourism and local economy standpoint. Yeah. I mean, the River Otter, we were there for a couple of days and everyone was there to see the beavers.
Yeah.
Like everyone...
Apart from this one guy who was like, beavers? I've lived here for 15 years, I've never seen a beaver. And we're like, how? Do you remember?
Yeah. Like, he's like, what are you looking at? It's like, those big brown things chewing down the entire tree.
Yeah, no, he was quite funny. But yeah, that's good news. I too have some good news. Are you ready?
Yes,
yeah?
Go ahead. What's your good news?
Well, my good news is, as so often wildlife and conservation good news is, it's relative good news.
Okay, yeah.
Conditional good news. My good news is that according to a recent IUCN, or the most recent update of the IUCN Red List for endangered and threatened species, some species of tuna, again, this is the relativeness, some species of tuna are thought to be recovering from not being fished to extinction.
That's such a conservation statement, honestly.
So many caveats. Some species of tuna are thought to be not almost extinct.
I mean, that's good for the select few tuna.
Yes, yeah. And, you know, they do caveat it even more, and they say, nonetheless, most stocks remain in severe decline and pressures on marine life as a whole are increasing. But the general gist of it is, the IUCN World Conservation Congress is currently being held in Marseille. It happens from the 3rd to the 11th. And ahead of each congress, they basically update their red list. The red list, I'm sure most of you will know, is kind of the metric for how conservationists can tell if plant or animal species are going extinct or not. Some numbers for you. 139,000 species have been assessed over the last 50 years, 39,000 of which are now threatened with extinction, and 902 of which have already gone extinct.
Wow.
So we've almost lost 1,000 species in the last 50 years, according to the IUCN Red List. So, you know, we haven't lost tigers yet, but we've lost 1,000 species, which is quite impressive. But the latest updates shows encouraging signs for 4 of the 7 tunas, okay?
Ooh.
And you'll like this again is a caveat. So the Atlantic bluefin tuna has moved from endangered to least concern, which is actually really impressive.
Okay, that to move up a category is very impressive.
Or down, actually, to move down a category.
Yes,
well.
Yeah. No.
This again is a caveat. Southern bluefin tuna moved from critically endangered to endangered.
Okay.
So good, but still terrifying. What was next? The albacore tuna moved from near threatened to least concern. Again, that was really good.
To least concern. That is a good step.
And yellowfin tuna, near threatened to least concern. So for 3 of them, really, really good. Atlantic bluefin, incredible. That's 2 steps. Endangered down to least concern.
Mm-hmm.
Southern bluefin, critically endangered to endangered, is only 1 step down. And, still needs quite strong conservation. But considering all of these tuna species were deemed at risk of extinction by 2011, it seems to think in the last decade, at least some of the conservation measures of tuna have been working. So, you know, cracking down on illegal fishing, strict fishing quotas.
So has that been particularly for tuna then? Like, have there been conservation efforts for those species? Or is it just generally marine protective?
Generally. The report notes that generally marine life is actually still going downhill.
Yes, that does not surprise me.
Yeah, the tuna thing wasn't interesting. Oh, but tuna, you know, they're not going extinct, but at the same time, they're not going extinct. They're flirting on that edge. And a little context, if you're interested in the World Conservation Congress, because I thought this was really, really interesting. I didn't really know this much about them. It's being held for the first time in 5 years after being postponed last year due to COVID-19. And it combines over 16,000 scientists with government ministers, NGOs, and crucially indigenous peoples, which I'm really pleased to see.
Mm-hmm.
And they're essentially sitting down and they're setting the conservation proposals that will determine the agenda for the upcoming UN summits on these various things. And the key issues this year are wildlife trafficking, plastic pollution, and protection of the Amazon.
Those are all very, very important.
So it's good news for some tuna.
I think, no, but it is good to put it into context because you read so much about mass declines of everything in every single ecosystem, particularly the ocean. And yes, you need to hold it in context that it almost everything is still declining, but it gives you a little bit of hope that if you do put conservation efforts into particular species, they can bounce back a little bit.
Another caveat is this report said, this doesn't mean that tuna aren't still declining. It could just mean that they're declining slower, which is still good.
Yeah.
But they kind of preface this report saying the nature of the data we have for these species means we can't tell if they're increasing or just declining slower. But we have got enough information to say, well, it's not critically endangered, it's endangered, or yada, yada, yada.
I mean, so we talked about this on the Biome podcast with Kate about no-take marine protected areas. Yeah. And I think data like you've just mentioned, the fact that fish species can bounce back even a little bit is almost, it's evidence for these areas where you let fish stocks recover and then they will bounce back naturally. It's only because we've got the industrial fishing industry, which has got trawlers that can fit like 7 jumbo jets in it, that you've got the scale of the problem. If it was left alone, I think the oceans could
absolutely
could bounce back.
I mean, as you say, Kate's made this point a fair few times. Fish are actually quite hard to drive extinct. They just have so many babies, so many eggs. It's, you know, it's, to drive a fish extinct is actually quite impressive. I mean, I know the Totoaba might be going that way, but for a spawning fish like the tuna, that's quite impressive, actually. And so it's good news that they're coming back.
Yeah, no, I think that is positive, because there's so much going on in the oceans. And I mean, we were talking about this in the car, actually, as you do, chats with zoologists in the car. There are a lot of threats to the ocean, and it's almost like even if humans stopped with the mass industrial fishing, like, where's the tipping point with climate change and, like, the halting of ocean currents? I mean, that could be a tipping point for marine life, and that's, even if we withdrew all our fishing fleets, that doesn't stop the ocean becoming more acidic or the current stopping.
I mean, just not fishing for tuna won't save tuna, because if the ice caps go, that'll still kill the tuna, because the changing in ocean pH and things like that. But it is still, you know, good news in this time when I think we all need a bit of good news.
Yeah, especially in the oceans. It's good to have a little bit of news.
Exactly.
That is positive.
So what is your animal of the week?
So mine is the Nile crocodile.
Ooh, I love a crocodile.
You love crocodile.
I was reading about crocodiles just the other day. I actually was, because I was looking at gharials, and then I got on a massive tangent and I was like, oh,
gharials are so awesome.
Gharials are quite cool, aren't they?
The ones with the bulbous thing on the end of their...
Yeah. Got another tangent. Anyway, continue. Nile crocodiles.
So this was actually a suggestion from Love a Villain on Instagram. So this was someone who I asked, did a poll. Yeah, great Instagram name, by the way. And I asked for some suggestions of animal of the week, and Nile crocodile was one of them.
So excellent suggestion.
Thank you for the suggestion. So these are heckin' big crocodiles, to be very scientific. They are the largest crocodiles native to freshwater habitats in Africa. And they're found mainly in sub-Saharan Africa, kind of in the big central bit in Africa.
The big middle bit.
Yeah, big middle bit. If you look at their habitat range, it's like a massive block in central Africa. And across 26 different countries.
Oh, cool.
It's kind of their range. They're found in lakes, rivers, swamps, marshlands, mainly always freshwater. I mean, they could survive in salt water, but it's not really their preferred place to be.
That's not really their vibe.
So heckin' big was not really scientific, so I'll give you some numbers. So the male Nile crocodile can get up to 5 meters in length.
It's a big crocodile.
Yep. And weigh up to 750 kilos.
Wow. So that's almost a ton, isn't it?
Yeah.
That's a big crocodile.
I think there was even a specimen that was larger than that. So that was 6 meters long and weighed over 1,000 kilos.
Oh my. Is that the one they called Gustav?
Possibly. I think it was the one in the Guinness Book of Records that broke.
This big old crocodile.
It's like, how is it physically possible that it can get that big? So many of you might have seen documentaries about crocodiles in the past. They're really, really awesome predators. They're what's called opportunistic apex predators. And they're actually very aggressive for a species of crocodile. So they'll take basically any animal that's in their territorial range.
Comes down to the water,
So things like fish, reptiles, birds, mammals. And they are what you call ambush predators. So they can wait for really, really long periods of time, or kind of get themselves into a position where they could then attack their prey, take it by surprise.
I always think crocodiles give patience a new definition.
They do, they really do.
Imagine just sitting there for months on end. And it's fine, because you know at some point a wildebeest will come down to the water. You don't know when, but you're just going to sit there. You're just going to wait it out. I mean, it's ridiculous.
And it's so long that they have to wait, and especially when it's like those migratory patterns. That doesn't happen very often.
No.
So it's like, probably massive feeding, I don't know,
I think
event when
those like those big ones on the Grumeti River, with the ones which you see on the documentaries, they wait for the wildebeest and the zebras. Those are big crocodiles, and I think they feed in one sitting once. I think it's every 6 months migration. And then they just sit there for the rest of the time, just waiting.
Just like digesting. Just digesting, waiting.
Yeah, and getting hungrier and hungrier, and just waiting for the next wildebeest, you know? 6 months, it's incredible.
They are incredible, and part of the reason they work so well as ambush predators is because they have one of the most powerful kind of bites and grips out of any species of animal on the planet. So can hold on really tightly to their prey, and can also hold the large prey underwater as well for long periods of time, so they can actually drown their prey. So very, very efficient predators. And they are a sexually dimorphic species, so the females are about 30% smaller than the males. And it's all kind of, it's like a very hierarchical thing going on with crocodiles. So largest males are the most dominant.
Yeah.
So they'll have all the primary rights to like mating, feeding, basking spots. And apparently if this hierarchy is kind of disrespected, so to speak, they can have violent confrontations that can be fatal.
I saw a YouTube video once of a smaller crocodile getting in the way of the bigger crocodile, and the bigger crocodile just bites the other one's leg off.
Really?
Just like that, one bite. And then the other one just doesn't even really notice it, just kind of waddles away. That's the other thing I quite like about crocodiles, is that not only, you know, unlike us, they will keep growing as long as they're alive. They will only get bit. They never stop growing. As long as they're alive, they will keep growing. But also, they can just shake off the most incredible injuries. Like, you see two-legged crocodiles, because both front legs have been just ripped off by another crocodile. And there's this one, I think it's in a zoo somewhere. And so, yeah, maybe it's got an easier time of it. But it's missing almost its entire top jaw, because it just got ripped off by another crocodile. And it's just living just there. There's not much bothering it.
I mean, I think how long they've been around on the planet is testament to how well they actually survive.
Oh, love a big crocodile.
And they have those really cool, they're called nictitating membranes in their eyes.
Oh, you love a nictitating
membrane. I love the word. It's probably one of my favourite words in zoology. And it's these membranes that kind of slide across the eyes that let them be in the water. And super, super cool. I did not know this. But part of the reason, you know, we were saying they sit around for months, hours, whatever, just doing their thing, not moving, waiting for the prey. Apparently this is possible because they have these really, really high levels of lactic acid in their blood.
Oh.
So high that this would kill other vertebrates.
That's pretty mental. Like,
but for them, it's absolutely fine. So it means they can be motionless in the water for up to 2 hours.
Oh, wow.
So it means they can just sit there not moving at all. But what this does mean is that if they actually exert themselves too much, this increase in lactic acid levels, kind of when it's all released, can actually be fatal and kind of cause their organs all to shut down.
Oh.
Which has only mainly been seen like when humans kind of put them under too much stress and manhandle them or things like that.
Yeah.
But it is because of this lactic acid that they can just sit.
A bit like how, like, a pigeon, if you put a pigeon in a box to take it to an animal shelter, half the time you turn up and just dead out of shock.
Yeah.
Like, oh, okay, great.
But I thought that was a...
That is very cool. I mean,
a cool adaptation.
My little cool crocodile fact is that actually some crocodiles found in this, you know, are actually found at the very fringes of the Sahara, and they go into this state of estivation where they, like, find a cave, and they just hide in that cave. And they slowly shut everything down until the rains come and it fills up. I think they're called guelters. And I remember, I think I wrote a report on it in first year of university, these crocodiles hiding in these guelters. And so in places like Niger, Chad and things, you've actually got this weird ecosystem where you've got these kind of semi-permanent pools and oases in the middle of the Sahel, just on the border of the Sahara. It's really, really hot. And then every so often these crocodiles come out.
I remember reading that.
Do you remember?
Yeah, that was such a cool report.
It was quite. Oh, thank you. Yeah, I quite enjoyed it. And I remember reading about during the African pluvial period, the Sahara was actually a really lush savanna, and it was all really wet because of different climatic conditions way back when, in the kind of early Holocene. And people have actually found in the middle of the desert these cave paintings with crocodiles, just in the middle of the desert.
That is hippos so and things, which is
quite cool, isn't it?
I love that. There's also some very interesting genetics I thought you might
probably
already know, but you find interesting. So it was originally thought that these Nile crocodiles were most closely related to the West African crocodiles, but actually genetics has shown that they're more closely related to the crocodiles in the Americas. It was a new kind of genetics thing. So it's actually not the African ones that they share the most genetics with, it's America's.
I was reading a bit of crocodile genetics recently, and there was a bit of a claim. Stop laughing. I was bored. I was waiting for my car to get MOT'd, and I had my phone on me. So
it's absolutely brilliant.
And it was this interesting. There's this clade that they think that Crocodilus, the genus Crocodilius, of which the Nile crocodile is Crocodilus niloticus, actually originated in Australia, Southeast Asia, and has actually spread westward. So you've actually got the highest species diversity of crocodilians in Australia, Papua New Guinea, that's it. You've got weird ones. You've got Australian freshwater crocodile, you've got saltwater crocodile, you've got Siamese crocodiles. There's like four different species of crocodiles in New Guinea, and they're all really cryptic.
Wow, okay.
And then the mugger you got in India, and actually the Nile is kind of the furthest outpost of it. But that's really interesting if it's actually closer related to the American ones. That's quite cool. I just love
crocodiles. But yeah, I kind of only briefly kind of touched on that, but I'm sure you could... Go on a massive tangent on that. But yeah, it's kind of like an overview of Nile crocodiles. Do you want to do... What's your animal of the week, Ruby?
My animal of the week is the reticulated siren.
what the heck is that?
That is my drag name. I'm kidding, I don't do drag. But if I ever did, my drag name would be the reticulated siren.
I would support that.
Do you know what a siren is? Because until I read about this about a week ago, I didn't know what a siren was.
I haven't got a clue.
Yeah.
I mean, no.
No.
No, just enlighten me. What's a siren?
So sirens, and the genus name is siren, which is pretty cool, are a group of salamanders, aquatic salamanders, called sirens.
Very cool.
So the reticulated siren is quite cool because it's also known as the leopard eel. And it's a cryptic species. It's endemic to southeastern United States. It was only described in 2018. But it's a cryptic species because it looks almost indistinguishable from the other siren species. And a cryptic species is something that you have to kind of look at the DNA to figure out that it's different. So another example would be the tapir that we were talking about last week. Cabamani tapir. Or some people think that giraffes are a cryptic species because of the giraffe species problem, which maybe I'll do next podcast. And the reticulated siren is only known from three locations in southern Alabama and the Florida panhandle. And quite coolly, it's the largest newly discovered vertebrate species from the US in the last 100 years.
Really?
Yeah.
How big is it then?
It's about 2 foot long.
Oh my goodness.
It's a big salamander. It's about the length of this tape mail. Maybe just a little bit smaller. It's about that big.
Salamander? I'm thinking of a little lizard thing.
No, and it looks like Do I have a photo on my phone? Maybe I don't. I thought I did. So it's essentially a green axolotl, but without the back legs and stretched incredibly long.
So does it have the same kind of head thing?
Yeah, it's got the weird gills that come out.
So I love axolotl.
And so it's actually the fourth largest salamander in the world behind the hellbender of the Appalachians and the big giant salamanders in Southeast Asia, which may also be cryptic species. It's all basically, no one knows what on earth is going on with salamanders. And it's kind of this kind of greenish-grey, eel-like body with kind of leopard patterns on it, hence the name. Oh, there's a female goldfinch just sat outside there. Oh, they're on the lawn. Sorry, we're just sitting looking out over the lawn, and there's a river at the back of the garden. And there's also a wader down there. Can you see? I don't think that's a snipe. Shank? Might be a green shank. Sorry, one time we did see a snipe down... Yeah, I think that's a green shank.
Yeah.
One time I did see a snipe looking out this window. My first ever snipe, and I was sniped.
It's such a good window to look out. There's birds everywhere.
A cute little goldfinch on the lawn. That's lovely. Anyway, imagine an eel with two front legs, axolotl gills, and leopard patterns.
What happens with the... Is it like just a long tail?
It's
like
just
an eel?
A long tail like an eel, yeah.
Wow.
So it's quite cool. The first known specimen was collected in 1970, but was dismissed as just an aberrant or atypical siren lacertina. I don't know the common name, but, another siren, which we knew was around.
Yeah.
And it became something of a legend in the kind of longleaf pine ecosystem of North America, where you've got all these legends of Bigfoot, Sasquatch, and the Chupacabra. And so the leopard eel became another one of these legends. And then in the 1990s, a weird rainstorm happened, and this one herpetologist said he saw like 100 of them crossing the road. And then in 2009, another herpetologist called David Steen caught a single specimen in a crayfish trap on a military base.
Hmm.
Yeah, interesting, in Oklahoma. And in 2014, he caught three more sirens in Florida, and it was described in 2018 and given the common name, the reticulated siren, instead of the leopard eel. Because as the authors somewhat humorously note, the animal is neither a leopard nor an eel.
If they go by that logic, I feel like a lot of things get their name changing.
I mean, nothing's actually a fish, let's be honest here. Clouded leopard's not a leopard, and neither is a snow leopard. There's lots of things that aren't leopards that are called leopards.
And neither is a salamander,
no.
But it's quite a weird thing to see, though, particularly out of water. Because
wiggling across a road.
Yeah, if it only has two front legs.
Just kind of...
It'd be very comical to see one.
It's basically indistinguishable, aside from being larger, it's basically indistinguishable from Siren Intermedia and Siren Lacertina, making it a cryptic species, and so it was only mitochondrial and nuclear DNA analysis which told us it's a new species. The analysis also showed some really strong non-overlapping clades in the other siren species, suggesting there may be further cryptic species in this group. This is probably a case when I would say, well, what's in a species? I mean, just call it a species complex, for God's sake, and then you'd be fine.
Yes, we have issues with the whole species definition. I feel like we've written about this so many times in like uni reports, and it's like, it's so flawed, the idea that it's just based on can you interbreed and produce fertile offspring. It's flawed.
I mean, look at grizzly bears and polar bears is my go-to.
Look at humans.
Well, that's true. And you know, ecology and life history, we know almost nothing about its ecology and life history, and that's the end of that. we literally know nothing about its ecology and life history. That's it. We know it lives in the famous longleaf pine ecosystems of, you know, the northern Florida, Oklahoma thing. It used to be a much larger ecosystem. So, again, it's probably an aquatic ambush predator of small insects, larvae, maybe small fish and crustaceans. But we don't know. We're just guessing. The most recent large vertebrate discovered in the USA in the last 100 years, it's not Bigfoot. It's a small... Aww. It's a big salamander.
I think it's pretty cool.
So much cooler than Bigfoot, the leopard eel.
And it kind of has an axolotl head.
Do you know what? I'm going to get my phone. Oh, here we go. That's what it looks like.
That's so cool.
It's so weird.
I feel like it needs legs.
It does need legs. It does.
Like, especially because it's so... I'll try and describe it. So it looks kind of like a big slug, but with like a snake tail.
Yeah, yeah.
And yeah, it really needs legs.
It definitely needs legs. It's been getting on fine without legs for several million years. I mean, we've got fossils of this genus going back to the Eocene, so they've been around for yonks.
Okay, maybe it can do without
it. It can do without the legs. We've been going for 40 minutes. Do we want to do a little a break thing? And then?
Yeah, we could do a break and then go into... Yeah.
So, that is the end of our news of the... Emma's just lying on the sofa, she's knackered. She's not feeling that well. That is the end of our news of the week and our animal of the week segments. This can be a little break, we'll put a bit of a jingle in. If you'd like to go make a cup of tea or pause, this is a good place to do so. Come back after the break for our conservation story. So the next segment will be a bit quicker. Although I think we've been doing pretty swiftly, actually.
Yeah.
Compared to our usual ramblings.
Oh, yeah. Compared to, like, biome ones. I think, like, pushing 2 hours.
Join us after the break.
Hi, everyone. Welcome back. This is second part of Zoology Ramblings, episode 14. And so in this part, we're going to talk about our, I guess,
that's what we're going to talk about, yeah. Yeah, yeah, me too, that's actually what I was thinking.
Okay, let me try that again. Wider conservation stories. Do you want me to start?
Yeah, I went last with the reticulated siren.
Okay, yes, which is so cool. So this week, I'm going to talk about it's less about animals. It's not really about animals, but it's about this new coating that they've figured out that they can put on seeds to possibly help them survive drought conditions.
Oh.
So it's kind of looking to the future of a really arid climate.
That's kind of sci-fi.
And how we can put these coatings on seeds to maybe help them. So this was a very recent scientific discovery, I guess, so to speak, where it was published on the 2nd of September 2021, mm-hmm. which was literally a couple of days ago, on Monga Bay. And basically it was developed by scientists from the University of Massachusetts Institute of Technology.
MIT.
Yep. And King Mohammed IV, I think, Polytechnic University of Morocco.
Oh, I thought you actually meant King Mohammed IV, and I was like, what? Cool.
No, I think it
sounds like
it's
a great chap.
King Mohammed Polytechnic University, but I'm not sure which King Mohammed.
What V is it? Is it IV?
I think it's IV.
That's fourth, yeah.
Yes. Yeah. I just didn't write which king it was.
Which Saudi Arabian king was assassinated in 1975? Was it Sadiq Khan?
We do not need to bring that up.
No, okay, no.
I do now know who Sadiq Khan is. We're playing Trivial Pursuit.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway. So basically in agriculture all around the world, water is kind of the limiting factor, mm-hmm. particularly in the driest regions, and huge numbers of crops are at risk of dying basically in the germination stage or kind of early seedling stage. So basically what these scientists were doing is to develop a new seed coating that's made of biodegradable waste products that's then applied to the seed, and this prevents it from water loss and dying during drought. So get this, what it has in it is absolutely bonkers. So it's a combination of silk cocoons,
right.
orange peel waste,
right.
nitrogen-fixing bacteria.
Cool.
And then just there's two coatings and they put that onto the seeds.
That's so bonkers.
How they thought of this is incredible what science is now doing. So basically the outer layer is made of orange peel waste.
Right.
So this is turned into some kind of coating that then helps hold water.
To be fair, oranges don't dry out that
exactly,
quickly.
Yeah. And if you think of that, like waxy texture on an orange. So that's basically to keep the seed drying out when there's periods of water shortage. And this was actually inspired by the coats of seeds like chia and basil, which are designed to kind of keep the seed in a moist environment, enabling it to survive until like conditions are ripe for germination. And then you have the inner layer, which is this nitrogen-fixing bacteria, which you guys might know what that is. They are really important in the soil for kind of taking up nitrogen, breaking it up into a usable form that the plant can use. And they're held in place with material from silkworm cocoons.
Love it.
In case you just wanted to really, like, it gets even more crazy. So the idea is that when this seed is exposed to water and soil, these nitrogen-fixing bacteria will provide the nutrients it needs as it germinates, which therefore cuts down the need for external fertilisers.
So they've basically made it into an egg. They've got the shell, they've got the yolk.
Yeah.
That's so cool.
I mean, it's a bit like a really like self-containing seed.
Yeah.
And the fact that you need less external fertilisers is also great in, like, that we've talked about soil before. Our soils are so degraded. And part of that is the amount of chemicals that we are putting on it.
That's so cool.
But yeah, I thought this was an awesome solution, particularly kind of in the face of climate change, meaning that arid regions that are already dry will become
Morocco
much more,
as well.
Yeah, and which is why I think Morocco was a key partner in this. So currently, I think it's only been tested on common beans in field trials, but they're looking at upping the scale and then applying this to other crops as well to see if it'll work. And their reasoning behind it is, so it will make a seed more expensive because you're adding something to it. But that the farmer will save money on fertilisers, it should increase yields, they'll lose less to drought, So that cost should be offset over time. And also the hope is that you can just train farmers how to coat the seeds like that as they're planting.
Yeah.
So you don't have to get external people to come in. It's all like local.
Oh, I love this idea.
Yeah. Cool little innovative thing that is happening at the moment.
I think that's a really cool idea. It sounds very sci-fi. I love it. It sounds like something out of Dune, to be honest.
I know.
If anyone's excited for the new Dune film, as I am.
What is your conservation one, Ruby?
My conservation story is about jaguars in the US of A.
Very awesome.
Very awesome. So, basically, these two recent jaguar studies, and again, this is from an article on Monga Bay, we'll put, as ever, the links and papers we reference in the description, from an article on Monga Bay talking about these two papers, and they found that two recent jaguar studies have found that the USA has an area in it from the Mexico border all the way up to the Grand Canyon of about 20 million acres of suitable jaguar habitat.
Ooh.
They found that this area could support 100 or more jaguars and is 27 times larger than what the US currently designates as jaguar habitat.
So this is a very,
very cool,
naive question, and I feel like I should know this, but how many jaguars, like, are there jaguars currently in the USA?
Funny you should ask, because this is a key example of our favourite thing, a shifting baseline syndrome.
Our favourite thing.
We think of the jaguar as this cat which lives in the jungle, right? Of all the rainforest, you know, humid, wet, swampy, that's where jaguars lives. But no. Think again.
No.
The only reason jaguars live in tropical rainforests is because that's the only place we've left them to live in. So the jaguar actually evolved in Europe in the early Pleistocene, spread westward across Asia using Central Asian riverine kind of corridors, eventually made it to Beringia, crossed the Bering Land Bridge into North America, and when the first people crossed into North America via the same land bridge, there were jaguars there. Jaguars used to live all across North America, from California to Florida, and up to New York, and we found their fossils. We even found jaguar fossils up in Oregon. I think that's the northernmost limit.
Wow.
It's actually, you know, we think of it as this forest predator, but it's actually just as adaptable as the puma or the leopard, which, you know, leopards live anywhere. Mumbai, for instance. And it's only with the arrival of modern humans to North America and the quaternary megafaunal extinctions that jaguars are actually pushed southwards to South and Central America. But even so, when Europeans got to North America, there were still jaguars in this kind of belt from, you know, Arizona, Colorado, New Mexico, Oklahoma, all the way down to Florida. There were still jaguars in Florida when Europeans showed up. Europeans, however, brought guns, shot all the jaguars, and the jaguars were a victim of the US of A manifesting its destiny, and put in the same way the bison, and they shot all the bison, they shot all the bears, and the wolves all went. The jaguar also went. So now the jaguars ranges, you know, a big swathe of tropical South America and bits of Central America, and it's thought that northern Mexico is the northern limit of the jaguars range. But you do still get vagrant jaguars popping over into Arizona and New Mexico. And a kind of evidence of their adaptability is that of 60 jaguars recorded in the USA since the 1900s, over a quarter of them were found living in coniferous forest of at least 9,000 feet in elevation.
See, that just blows my mind. It really does show you the idea of shifting baseline syndrome, but also that thing that we've talked about before, that animals don't read your text.
No, they don't.
Like, if you told me to describe jaguar habitat, coniferous forest in upland area would not be a place I would tell you.
So the papers that the Monga Bay article is quoting, and I actually don't know the full name of this paper because it didn't give an et al, it just listed all the authors. So Sanderson, Fisher, Peters, Beckman, Bird, Bradley, Bravo et al, 2021, a systematic review of potential habitat suitability for the jaguar, brackets Panthera onca, in central Arizona and New Mexico, comma USA, is the paper they're on about. So essentially what they found is that actually 20 million acres of the southern USA are actually suitable jaguar habitat. And it's called it already exists as a conservation unit called the Central Arizona New Mexico Recovery Area, CANRA.
Very, very nice.
It's actually larger than some famous jaguar conservation areas in South America, like Selva Maya or Iguazu Falls.
I mean, you think about the ones we talked about, the jaguar like corridors in Costa Rica.
Yeah.
They're tiny.
Yeah.
Like, Central America is not very wide. The countries are tiny. And if they're possible there, yeah. then the US, the space you have in the US yeah. is phenomenal.
And this is all the way up to the Grand Canyon. But this Canra area was actually overlooked in the most recent 2018 US Jaguar recovery plan. Because this 2018 plan only looked at a narrow, I think it's like an 80-mile band along the Arizona-Mexico border. And obviously that's not really enough for any Jaguars. And so they said, there's no point. And so what that did, that decision, essentially just left the conservation of the northernmost Jaguars to the Mexican government. And essentially the US went, nah, not our problem, mate. Because they, I would argue, knowingly looked at only a little part of the area they had. And obviously, when you think about it, actually, no, okay, so right, now the scientists are saying, right, we've got this 20 million acres, now they're actually starting to petition them, because it can support over 100 Jaguars, that's grand. And actually, when you think about it, there's always going to be resistance to bringing back a big carnivore. But America's full of big carnivores, you know, they've got bears, they've got wolves, they've got puma, they've got wolverines, they've got... Well, three types of bears, including polar bears. They've got coyotes,
mm-hmm.
bald eagles. And actually, they brought back the grizzly bears and the wolves and the bald eagles. And now America's bonkers for bears, wolves, and eagles. You know, the eagles and the flag and everything. So actually, I reckon if they can actually protect that area, there's a pretty good chance, you know. And a jaguar's, you know, it's not like a bear. It's not going to go rummaging through your trash. Like, you don't, if you're in a habitat with jaguars, you don't necessarily know the jaguars are there. You know, they're solitary. Live in the shadows, pretty shy.
Mm.
It's not like a lion. If you come across a jaguar, the jag is more likely to run. So I'm, you know, quite optimistic. If they can actually get this legislation passed, if they can convince the USA to protect it, then you might have North American jaguars again, which would be great.
I feel like because it's already kind of a conservation area, that is more promising as well, because... It's the same with the UK, same with loads of other places that are looking at rewilding or reintroducing predators. It's that conflict with people. It's like, if there are large numbers of people in that area, they will object, even though Mumbai has the highest density of leopards. And most people don't see... Like, they know they're there, but they're more like... They'll take dogs and pigs and things like that. But if it's more like wilderness
and conservation area... And it is, the area is wilderness. I mean, there's a thought that it might happen on its own. So, in the past 25 years, at least 8 jaguars have been recorded living their secret jaguar lives that don't concern the lives of us in Arizona or New Mexico. In 2021 already, a jaguar was photographed 50 miles north of the Mexican border in the Chiricahua Mountains of Arizona. And it's thought that these animals come from a small population in the Sonora Mountains in Mexico, about 100 miles away. So it's possible. It was thought unlikely with the building of the Trump administration's border wall, which was a kind of moronic, irresponsible, immoral, and frankly dangerous, you know, architectural thing. But now that that wall is slowly both falling apart and the Biden administration is not rebuilding it, it's possible that actually the jaguars might do it on their own. They might just kind of slink back in, which I think would be really even cooler than us bringing them back, would be if they just kind of, you know, that kind of arrogant way that cats walk. They kind of just saunter over the border like, it's North America. Lovely. Great. I'm back.
No, that was something I was going to ask about the border wall, because there was that really powerful image, actually. Was it the latest, was it a big photography competition?
Was it the Roadrunner?
Yeah.
Yeah.
The Roadrunner on the Mexican border with all the barbed wire fences. Yeah. And I think that just showed, like, particularly with jaguars, if you had a defensive, like, structure of that size, nothing can get past it. Mm. So it's good to know that there are gaps or places where they could cross.
And I hope, you know, as nice as it would be if they did it on their own, you know, it would probably be more successful if people sat down and said, right, we're going to get 5 females, 5 males, dump them in there, monitor them, satellite tag them, make sure they're not going after sheep or whatever. But yeah, you know, we've spoken about jaguars quite a lot before, both on this podcast and on Biome, but I'm going to keep talking about jaguars. Jaguars are epic. I feel like they get overlooked. Everyone's like tigers, lions, leopards. But jaguars, I think
jaguars
overlooked.
Are very sexy.
They are very sexy, yeah.
Like, you look at one, you're like, wow.
Just majestic.
Absolutely. But I feel like the US could be quite suited to it, like you say, because they already have a lot of those predators. and that they're used to it.
Mm.
Whereas, I mean, a bit far-fetched, but if you suggested bringing back something like a Jaguar to the UK...
Or even a Lynx.
I mean, yeah, that's the point. Yeah. Even a Lynx, which has never really caused harm to people, does take sheep, but it's not really a risk to people. That has caused uproar. Yeah.
But Americans are all, you know, hats, guns, outdoors, horses. They're all, you know, they're quite used to that outdoorsy life. They go out, you know, riding in the hills and they say, oh, look, a grizzly bear. That I can't do an American accent. But they're very, they're you know, especially in that area, especially in middle America, they're outdoorsy, they're tough. They like nature. They like all that stuff.
And I think it's part of who they are. Like you're saying, on the flag, you've got the eagle is hugely important. It's, I think people are proud they've got grizzly bears, things like that. And kind of, like you say, it's that resilience, that toughness of like, yeah, we have bears, we have eagles, we have all these, like Wolverine. Whereas I think a lot of other countries wouldn't be suitable for that.
Yeah.
But then with Biden, there is more hope, but that you need collaboration when it's animals that cross borders.
Yeah.
So you would need collaboration between the Mexican government and the American one.
Mm-hmm.
It's not even about people. It's not about immigration. It's about jaguars.
It's about come on, guys, jaguars.
Like, there are some things you can come together over, and jaguars is one.
You just know that someone's like, we don't want Mexican jaguars coming into the US of A. I'm like, no, but actually they're actually in America before they got to Mexico, because it was northward. Oh my God. Ah! Great American biological interchange, guys. Come on.
This is why you need kind of paleo education. Yeah, exactly.
So yeah, that is the end of my conservation news. So are we going to wrap up there, do you think?
Yeah, I think that's everything we're going to talk about. We are going back to university soon, which means we will be in the same place.
Yes, our final year of uni.
Woo! So hopefully, we hope to do these quite regularly.
Yeah.
I think it's a nice... We love sharing research with you guys.
Yeah. Nerding out.
We love nerding out about everything animal related. But yeah, I don't exactly have a date for you when our next one's going to be, but we will keep you posted and hope you enjoyed this latest episode.
Yeah, and if you want to keep up to tabs with what we're doing, we are on Instagram. That's kind of where all of our wildlife stuff gets channeled. So we post about Zoology Ramblings on our Instagram as well. So I am at Roby Watkinson Wildlife on Instagram, and Emma is at Emma Hodson Wildlife on Instagram. You can also check out The Biome Project, which is our other kind of wildlife filmmaking and education online platform, which is Biome Project on Instagram. And it's also on YouTube, and for the website is www.biome-project.co.uk.
Mm-hmm.
So cool. Check us out and we will see you next time.
See you next time. Bye.